Hi, I'm Rob, and I'm an alcoholic.
Handsome Rob, that's another name that I have for her, yes. I tell my friends, you should come to legal, they'll give you a nickname and everything, it's great. This is my home group. It fills my heart with joy. I see hope in all of these faces that come here on a regular basis. And what I've found over the years is looking at other people and realizing that they have hope gives me hope. Makes me realize that I am not hopeless. Which is probably why they sent me on that whole journey to go help other people, right? Because with doing that, I get greater joy. This group, what it means to me is, so I was 19 years old in 1987 when I came into my first meeting. That makes me 46 now. Holy crap. Yeah. What this means to me, and I lost this journey for a little bit, was that I was like, oh, wait a minute. I know when I walked into this meeting for the first time, it brought me right back. Oh, right. I know exactly what this feels like. This felt like home. And it was because, and I didn't think much of it at the time, I was a young person going to meetings. Luckily, at that time, it was popular to send your kids to rehab. I thank Nancy Reagan, War on Drugs. Send your kid to rehab, and the meetings were just full of young adults. If you're new to this meeting and you think you don't belong, by all means, stay. Chances are, when you say you've been here for the first time, I'm taking a line from another person that comes to this meeting, they'll probably come at you like a stampede of bunny rabbits. Just let them run all over you. You'll feel at home in no time. When I had first come to this meeting, excuse me, I had the grace of being the door greeter. And at the time, we were at another meeting space and the door was elevated on a stoop. And it was about, half a story high. And this young lady was walking back and forth, you know the type, of just trying to sniff out a meeting. She wanted to be here, but was too afraid to walk through the doors. And three young ladies standing on the curb looked at her and knew exactly what was going on and turned to her and said, "Are you looking for the meeting?" She said yes, and she immediately started crying. And the three young ladies just graciously took her right to the front step, right in the front of the meeting, sat on either side of her, gave her tissues when she kept crying, and just walked her through this journey. That has been my experience from the first time that I decided to come to a meeting. I have been taken from the next right spot and put into the next, and carried on by countless peoples in these rooms. It's my duty now, and it's my pleasure now to do exactly the same thing. So, 1987, young Robbie from Connecticut. Let's just say my life was the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more, period. There was nothing else. It was whittled down to exactly that. I would wake up in the morning and I would get loaded. And I would go at night and I would still be loaded. And then on weekends, I'd party, right? It seems unreal, but it was exactly that. And it was fast and it was furious from the time that I graduated high school right to the time I walked into the meeting. My last day was something like this. Let me back up. So I grew up in a family that wasn't open, right? Let's just say at best. Beautiful people, wonderful. I'm unfortunately largely alcoholic. At the age of 46, which is my age now, my mom passed after struggling in and out of these rooms, right? So that's really with me now. My grandfather, her father, had passed after having a stroke and being diabetic and having his legs amputated. I mean, these are the physical manifestations of alcoholism, and they've taken their toll on my family. So I use that as like my roadmap. Clearly, I didn't make the connection when I was getting loaded and my mom going to meetings and rehabs with my, you know, I actually said something as brazen as, like, well, I'll never be an alcoholic. But I pride myself on my drug use. Considerably smarter as an addict. So Robbie, the addict in Connecticut at 19 years old, is doing things that I swore I would never do before. And I'm driving with a buddy of mine who was a running buddy in my neighborhood. Joey was his name. And he was fresh on a relapse, right out of rehab, and partying with me. And we're driving up the Merritt Parkway of Connecticut, which is a lovely tree-lined stretch of highway. And I was doing things I said I wasn't going to do anymore. And we're pulled off on a dirt road on the Merritt Parkway. Not a good idea. And we're partying. And he looks to me and says, you know, I know about this meeting. Maybe we should go to it. I was like, dude, that is so random. Why would you ever say something like that? Let's just carry on, right? To that effect. So the next day, I go to my job, and I'm doing yet another thing that I swore I wasn't going to do. I wasn't going to get loaded in the middle of the day anymore, but here I was on a lunch break in the woods, because that's what you do at 19 in Connecticut, right? Like, you're in the woods partying. I wasn't allowed in bars. And I'm wondering, what is the matter? Like, and the thing was that it wasn't working anymore. Like, I wasn't catching that buzz, and I was trying really hard. And I remembered what Joey had said to me. And it was at that moment that I had my first glimpse of hope. And the idea of that, that first glimpse of hope in my mind, is me exercising the first three steps perfectly. And if I break it down to the first three steps being, I can't, you can, maybe I'll let you, that was it. So I was excited, like literally felt the weight of the world off of my shoulders at that moment as I'm sitting in the woods trying to get loaded. So I drove back to my the shop that I was working at. There were no cellular phones back then. And I called Joey, and he was home and picked up the phone. Imagine how that works now. Love the timeline thing. And I said, Joey, you mentioned this meeting that we could go to. And I was like, dude, what are you talking about? And he's like, no, this meeting you had said. And he's like, oh, okay. Well, I'll come and get you. You can... he said, it's a rule, you can come to your first meeting loaded. So I'll pick you up and we'll party before we go. So if you're in this room and you're loaded right now, it's fine. You're in the right spot. So Joey comes in, and the thing of it was that, like, here we are trying to party in the woods, and I'm still not getting my buzz. It's not working anymore. And we decide I have to go home and shower now and get ready. And on the way to my house, I had said something offhanded like, wouldn't it be funny if we got pulled over right now? I said, that's not funny. You shouldn't say things like that. And I pull up my street, and my house is up on a little hill, and I look at the top of the hill, and there are two squad cars sitting in front of my house. Joey didn't want anything to do with what I was going through, right? Like, he's like, just drop me off, take me home. I had 60 bucks in my pocket and a half a tank of gas. And I figured I was just going to run for the hills. The trouble with that was that I had already had that glimpse, that little bit of hope that I just mentioned, with the promise that I would be helped. And then I was at this crossroad that said, you can go happy, joyous, and free, or jails, institutions, and death. It was as clear as day. Everything is clearer in hindsight, mind you. That's not what I was like, holy shit, what do I do? You know, that was more like in the moment. But now I look back at this, like this was clarity. So I pulled back onto my street and I pulled up to the house and I figured, oh, I got it all. I see exactly what's going to happen here. The cops are going to pull me out. All my neighbors are there. Oh, I had pulled into my neighbor's driveway earlier and thrown all my like paraphernalia into the truck. They're looking out at me like, what the hell is this kid doing? He's out of his mind. So the second trip up, I walk past the squad cars. They don't get out. I'm like, shit, my dad's home. He's totally going to lecture me now. And he's standing there as I walk in the door, and he doesn't say a word. Now, I'm sweating bullets at this point. I'm like freaking out. I'm looking out the windows. Welcome. Looking out at the windows. I'm wondering when the next shoe is going to fall. And the two squad cars pull away. The whole idea of white light experience, as I said, is in hindsight. And the last thing that I said on my second trip up that street was, God, please, get me through this. I swear I'll go to this meeting. And I've been sober since. That stays with me. I forget it a lot, but it stays with me. So I call Joey. He answers the phone. I tell him the cops are gone. He said, great, come and pick me up. We're going to go to the meeting. The message comes from every form of person in this room. It doesn't matter if you've been sober for 100 years or one day. Joey was getting high with me earlier that afternoon, and he was coaching me on what this meeting was going to be like. He was telling me, like, guys are going to want to come up to you. It's a men's meeting. Freaked me out because I never got along with guys, and I always felt less than. And he's like, but it's not a gay thing. You know, they just want to hug you and, like, welcome you. Like, they're going to give you your phone their phone numbers, and you just take them. And, you know, oh, you need to get a sponsor, right? Like, I'm like, okay, this is cool. These are, like, crib notes for, like, acting as if, like, I know what I'm doing. Like, yeah, this is totally cool. I've been to these meetings before, right? Like, I don't need help. So, Joey's giving me the crib notes, and he is taking me to my first meeting, and I remember fluorescent lights in the church and similar, lots of readings, and guys tried to hug me, and they gave me their phone number, and the first guy that actually came up to me and gave me his phone number, I said, well, I need a sponsor, you'd be my sponsor, and he said, his eyes lit up, and he was like, yeah, I got a live one, right? Like, I was trying to be all bad and everything, right? Like, black leather jacket, acid wash jeans, like, you know, pulled on tight. 87 kids, come on. None of that mattered. The only idea was that I was willing, that I wanted what you had. Like, I just wanted to not go to jail. I wanted to not feel hopeless. So life got good really fast. Like, it's day 5. I already skipped a meeting, right? Like, because I had a date with this girl, right? If you don't know why, yeah, it's ironic, but nevertheless, I've said that before. Anyway, so it comes to Friday night. So it's October 21, right, is when I went to my first meeting. My first day clean. And so it's Friday night, and this is after the day that we skipped a meeting, and my girlfriend and Joe are, like, you know, talking about plans, and I come into the house, and they're like, so we're going to a cake party tomorrow. Do you want to come? And I knew at that point what they were telling me was exactly the opposite of everything else that I had heard over the last 5 days. And I said, well, I'll let you know tomorrow. And I walked out of that house, and I sat in my car, and I cried like a baby, because I was alone. That was my support group that had evaporated. And so Saturday morning came around, and I had this pocket full of phone numbers that I didn't know quite what to do with, but I just started dialing. And this one fella, Jesse, had picked up, tall Hawaiian fellow, super chill. And he asked, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, I'm busy, you know, I'm good. You're doing fine? Oh, yeah, no, I'm fine. Want to come hang out? Oh, no, I got things and stuff to do. It's fine, I'm good. He says, well, tell me this. What's your address? We're coming to get you. He wanted to bring me to go play basketball. I told him I didn't play basketball. He said, fine, you can just hang out with us. And I sat on the side of the basketball court. He said, we're going to go get lunch. And we just hung out at lunch. And he didn't tell me anything profound, but he just let me be. And he picked me up, and he put me into the next right spot. And right before he dropped me off, he asked if I wanted to go to a dance. There was a Halloween dance. I said, no, no, I'm not dancing. And I'm certainly not getting dressed up for Halloween. And he said, well, that's fine. You can just meet us at the meeting that we all meet at first, and then we can go from there. It was a trap. I was willing. So, of course, I went to that first dance, and it was a horrible, there was a table like this, and it had 2-liter bottles of orange soda. I remember as clear as day. And this mom and her daughter that I found out later come up and they're like, you're cute, why don't you dance with us? And I was like, okay. This began my illustrious career of AA dances every Saturday night for the next 2 years. And I'd like to timeline this. The music then was, of course, Beyond, and if you'd like to reference it, you can remember Rob Bass, It Takes Two, and Salt and Pepper, Push It Good. Is that not internationally known? Somebody got it. Oh, my God. The fact of the matter was that it was, you know, the people and the places and the place to be and the fun and the I came to New York City, like little 19-year-old Robbie said, okay, I'll go to a dance in New York City with you guys. And we drove down to St. Mark's Place. There used to be a nightclub there, and there's nobody old enough to remember this. But nevertheless, there was a nightclub, and it was in a townhouse, right? And it had, like, sayings painted on the stoop stairs. I mean, it was random, and they had, you go underneath the stoop, and there's people doing this dance in line, right? And we're all in unison. And the rumor is, as I had heard it, it was the birthplace of the electric slide. We, of course, brought it to Connecticut. I remember the people that I was with in that car. I'm still in touch with them to this day. They are always part of my life. By just saying yes and being part of service, if you want to call it that, kept me forever tethered to these people. I may not see them for another 20 years, but when I do see them, that's it. We're instantly connected. So life got good, and I moved to this fair town. And I went to the meetings that you New Yorkers have. And somebody yelled at me in a suit. I used to wear suits all the time. And I still do. Anyway. Somebody yelled at me for spilling coffee on the floor. I was about 8 years sober. And I didn't clean up that coffee quite fast enough. And he wasn't having it, and neither was I. So I showed him, and I didn't go to meetings for about 4 years. There's a thing, I guess, that has been surveyed that just says there's a fade-out period. It happens within young alcoholics, young adults getting sober. And it's like, that was perfect timing for me, and that was the dynamite excuse that I had. Lame, but dynamite. So at the end of all of this, what ended up coming up was me talking to a guy in Connecticut, because I certainly didn't want anybody in New York City to know what was going on. What was happening in my life? What was happening at that point was I was living on the Upper West Side on the 42nd floor. I had a balcony, and I was making ideas, plans for, well, how can I make it look like I just fell off of this building? The idea was that I wanted to get loaded. I just didn't want to be anymore. I was not in the middle of the boat. I was hanging on by a pinky onto the edge with dear life. So I'm talking to this guy, and I tell him all of my woes, and he then asked me, so when was the last meeting you went to? Like, clearly you're not listening to me. That's not it. But he was right. And smart feet took me to a meeting on the Upper West Side that was exactly like the meetings that I remember back in Connecticut. And the only thing that I knew to do to get myself into the middle of the boat again and feel like I was a part of was to ask them to be of service. So I asked them if I could be their greeter, and they said yes. And then I asked them if I could make coffee, and they said yes. And slowly and surely, much slower, I got myself back into the middle of that boat. I'll go on the service thing. My boat has become huge. The people and the hope that I see every day is immense. I am so grateful for that. The only way that I could keep that going is if I just keep reaching out to more and more people. Keep saying yes to other things that I would otherwise not want to say. There's one beautiful event that happened here a few years back called Icky Pop, right? And they called for service. They wanted service positions to be filled in the middle of August, right? Like, I would rather be at the beach than in a cold hospital. Okay, fine, I'll go. But I'm not promising anything, okay? So I show and I stand up, and I didn't get elected for the first thing that I was part of, right? Like, I was like, whatever. Whatever. And then the next thing came up, and it was like literally the most perfect thing that I could be doing. I work in retail, and I have for a long time. And my commitment that I stood up for was T-shirt making. Merchandising, yes. Fucking T-shirt drama for a year. And it really was the most perfect thing. And what that entailed was just me making T-shirts. Whoop-de-doo, right? What the beauty of it was for me was, so we go to this hotel. There's 5,000 sober young people off the hook, right? Like, unbridled enthusiasm every moment of every day for 5 days. So I'm in the middle of all this. I'm in one spot, so I get to see everything that goes on as it goes by me. Zane was the head of security for this, and he had come to me and had told me about his overnight shift where this young fellow during the conference had overdosed. Not overdosed, but had gotten loaded and was passed out in the hallway. That's relatively close to the truth, right? And I was like, holy shit, that's wild, and I can't believe this. And this was a story that he had shared with me. And I was like, wow, that's something else. And then that was Saturday night. Saturday night, Shelley and I had to do the sobriety countdown. Sobriety countdown was, in this one room, was 3,000 people, and then it was teleconference to 2,000 others. And Shelley and I are standing on stage with a Jumbotron in front of 3,000 people, counting from the person with the most amount of time to the person with the least. So this guy gets up 50 years, we'll say, right? I think it was even more. And everyone applauds. And we go down to, we get to day one. And the kid that had been passed out in the hallway walked up to the stage. And the guy with the most amount of time gave him a big book. That's what it was all about. That's what this program is all about. That was so fucking beautiful. And it's as simple as that. And if I get into my head and twist it all up, if I can just get a glimpse of that moment again, it'll be okay. I'm so grateful for that moment. I will avail myself to that moment at any cost. If you come to me and you say you need my help, I'll be there. We're not alone. You're not alone. I'm not alone. There's no need for it. So when I'm asked to do things that I'd rather not do, I'm in the habit now of just saying yes. And so Carlos called me and asked if I'd speak, and I said yes, and I'm glad I'm here. Thanks.